Welcome to Living Above the Drama. I'm your host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio, and today my guest is David Burnett, a special ops veteran and the author of Making of a Night Stalker. The book provides the reader a glimpse into the unique world of the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment. David's journey starts in a conventional Army unit, from where he pursues his dream of becoming an MH-47G Chinook helicopter crew chief in the most secretive and elite aviation unit in the world. After almost a year in training, he is deployed with the 160th, and it is nothing short of intense. His new unit's mission is exactly what he hoped for. He continues to hone his craft over the next 4 years, and after 5 deployments with the unit as a crew chief, he is discharged from the military and begins a journey into deep depression. Alcohol becomes the most important thing in his life, and David finds himself on a new and reckless battlefield against an enemy he never saw coming. Making of a Night Stalker has been reviewed and approved by the Pentagon. David, welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show today. I know you are doing many, many things, among which is creating inventions and patents for military use. And I'm just so excited and very pleased that you could join us today. So welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much, Georgiana, for having me. I really appreciate you taking the time to have me on the show and let me tell my story.
Well, it's quite a story that you have, and let's begin at the beginning because, you know, you had a fairly normal kind of childhood, you know, growing up in Colorado. And after high school, you went to college for aviation technology. So, you know, tell us about what you were thinking and what your passions were back then, and because that's the beginning of how you found yourself where you did.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was always passionate about aviation, grew up in an aviation family, and knew that's what I wanted to pursue after high school. So started going to school for aviation technology, and coincidentally, there was an Army recruiting station on the college campus I was attending. Well, I was going to school to be a fixed-wing pilot or commercial airline pilot, flying passengers, and I had an interest in doing something out of the norm, and that was rotary wing aviation or flying helicopters versus airplanes. So I went to the recruiting station, and they promised me the world and, you know, said I could work on helicopters and maybe one day fly them or fly on them as a crew chief. And I said, great, that's what I want to do. So I took the ASVAB, which is the military pre-entrance exam testing that you need to take to determine where your aptitude is in terms of knowledge and mechanical inclination. And that kind of your score determines what MOSs or military occupational skills you are best suited for. So after I took the test, I scored pretty high, and they said I could work on any of the military helicopter, any of the Army helicopters that the Army has in its arsenal. And I chose the biggest one, being the Chinook, and that's kind of where my journey started.
Wow, yeah, and I remember we talked about this. This was a really interesting piece of trivia that I didn't know, and I'm sure the listeners don't know either, that helicopters in the military are named after Native American tribes. You were telling me the Apache, the Black Hawk, the Chinook, and you're not sure as to why, but that's a very, I would love somebody to, you know, I'm going to have to try to find a way to find out why that is so, because that's an interesting bit of trivia, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy, and I haven't really done much digging into it either, so that's definitely something I'm going to do a little more research on and see if I can't get back to you with an answer.
Either that or you've got to put it in the next book, David, one of the two, and get back to me because I'd love to know. Now, curiously, your dad was a a fighter jet pilot in the Marine Corps, but he was serving during peacetime, correct?
Correct, yep.
And you had some cousins who were working commercially, flying commercially, and, you know, so you were surrounded by people who like to be in the air. Did you fly a lot prior to actually going to college? Was it something, you know, not everybody, just because they grew up with it, necessarily likes it, but were you enamored of it as a young person?
I was, and it wasn't so much me flying as more as it was going to a lot of air shows or different military bases and seeing kind of these flight lines and all this aviation stuff happening around me, which really enamored and piqued my interest into that industry early on.
Mm-hmm. So this was something, it almost seems there was a little bit of a destiny in that, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So you did find out at one point after your basic training and you got orders to go to Fort Campbell in Kentucky, but you found out that you wouldn't be working the way you thought you'd be working, right? That things had kind of changed from what you were told at the recruiting desk there. So tell us, you know, your process, because you went through a process to get to do the work you wanted to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was told by the recruiter, and I'm sure a lot of young soldiers are told certain things by recruiters that don't end up happening, but that's just the way of the business. So I was told I would be a crew chief, where I would be flying on the back of these helicopters and being the subject matter expert and the mechanical go-to if anything were to happen in flight or otherwise. Well, I finished basic training and I finished advanced individual training at Fort Eustis in Virginia. And then I get orders to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where I'm stationed at my first unit, where I am a Chinook maintainer. So all I'm doing is working on the helicopter in the hangar, not actually flying.
Mm-hmm. And you were not happy with that, correct? I mean, this was disappointing to you, I believe. And then you cultivated, you came up with a new plan, right?
Correct, yeah. It wasn't super disappointing for me at the onset, but I was with the unit, my first unit, for only about 3 months before we deployed to Afghanistan for a 13-month deployment. And it was there that I quickly realized that this is not what I signed up to do. Although I was utilizing my mechanical inclination and working on the aircraft, I wanted to be in the back of the aircraft flying and going out on missions.
Mm-hmm. So you had the warrior spirit, and you weren't satisfied with just working mechanically on them. Let me ask you this. A lot of people, because I shared with you, I have a son in the military. A lot of people kind of wonder if there isn't a bit of a romance about all of it. Was there a certain kind of a, you know, maybe male romance that, you know, the idea was to jump into the fray and be part of the action and, you know, actually get into the mission? Because later on down the road, we know that, you know, things changed for you and there were some, you know, kind of unexpected results from the missions that you were in on. Do you think at the beginning there was more of a romantic sense of the whole idea of going out on missions and seeing action and all of that?
Absolutely. And I would chalk it up to the effect that, you know, when I was working in the hangar, I was kind of, you know, dating the B class, B level sophomore, junior varsity cheerleader, whereas I would see these crew chiefs out on the flight line, and they were more or less dating the senior varsity cheerleaders who were, you know, the talk of the town. And that was my goal. I wanted to be that guy.
So you kind of, when I say romance, and you went right into that and painted us a picture, you saw it more or less as something that you know, really is a little bit of a fantasy. I mean, the cheerleaders, whether they're the varsity or the junior varsity, they're still cheerleaders. But for you, you wanted to do what you thought was the optimal, the ultimate, in terms of being part of this particular unit and going out on these particular missions. So
absolutely,
you go through the whole thing. You know, you go to your first deployment, and you're working as a mechanic, and you are not happy. So tell us what you did after that first, really blush of awareness that you did not want to be on the ground. You really wanted to be on the helicopter in action.
Yeah, so towards the tail end of the deployment, I find out that I can apply to a Special Operations Aviation Regiment, otherwise known as 160th. And that was essentially the only way that I could progress into the crew chief role, because the unit I was in, they didn't have any crew chief slots. So the only way for me to essentially fly in the back of this helicopter was to put in an application to go into a completely different unit that was super specialized and had a selection process to get in, and a long process of which they vet all their soldiers before you can even be considered to be in that unit. And so I fill out this lengthy application, get it turned in, and I find out a few months before we are set to head back to the States, so I'm still in Afghanistan, that I get accepted to try out for this new unit known as 160th. So I'm elated. Super excited. We get back to the States a few months later, and I'm in the States for about 2 weeks. I have 2 weeks before I have to get ready to go through a 160th selection process, which is known as Green Platoon.
Okay. And what happens when you go through that process? What happens in that whole evolution?
So Green Platoon is a 5-week process where you cover land navigation, combatives, combat lifesaver course, which is advanced first aid and combat life-saving techniques and procedures. And this is all done over the course while you're being thrown all these impossible tasks and physically demanding exercises. And all this time, you're trying to just make it the next minute and the next hour and into the next day, hoping you get through the entire course. So we started with about 86 guys, graduated a little bit less than half of those guys. I was one of the guys who graduated, thankfully, because the whole time I had that goal in mind of becoming a crew chief. So I get through the selection process, and then I get assigned my new orders. And my new orders bring me to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. So I didn't have to move or change duty stations at all. Luckily, I got to stay in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And that's where I begin my process of starting to become a crew chief.
Right. And let's just take a step back a little bit, because I know people are very curious about special ops and all of the unique possibilities, the berets and, all of the SEALs and all of this stuff. And as I shared with you in the pre-interview, my son went through that training. He came out and he decided he didn't want to do it because he said he didn't want to learn to be a killer, which was kind of like a relief to me. But, he's still in the Army and he still serves. But didn't want to have to function on that particular level. Talk to us about, a lot of people don't understand that training to be a special ops really brings you to the brink. It brings you to the brink of your capacity, your resilience, your resistance, your emotional, physical, and mental limits. I think a lot of people romanticize that as well. And they think about, special ops people as, kind of supermen. But in fact, it really is designed to grind you down to your most basic resilience, isn't it? I mean, didn't you feel like pushed to the limits through that training?
Yeah, absolutely. They want to take you to your breaking point and further to make sure after you reach that point, you're still able to perform the task at hand. Those are the people they want in that community. And if you can't perform at a certain level when you hit or you're past your breaking point, then you're not going to be able to meet the standards that they request when you're actually in the unit.
Right. And some of that does have to do, from what I've been told, it does have to do with the concern that if you do get captured, there's that kind of resilience that's required to survive that. Was that part of your training? Was that, were you aware, you know, that this was all part of the training, had a lot to do with your own survival as well as your ability to perform the tasks that you were being asked to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And that took part in a different course after I made it through Green Platoon. And that school was called SEER School, or Survive, Evade, Resist, Escape, which was a 3-week course where you learn survival techniques and how to live off the land if you're shot down behind enemy lines. And the course concludes in the final week in a prison camp where you're essentially interrogated, and you take everything you've learned in the first few weeks of the course and you apply it in the last week while you're captured. So you're getting interrogated and punished in certain ways that I won't delve into, just because I know after redactions from the Pentagon in my book, they don't want me to talk about it. But yeah, there was a point there in training where I couldn't decipher if I was in training or if I was actually captured by someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds pretty realistic and pretty harrowing. Now, your book was reviewed and approved by the Pentagon. Is that something you volunteered to do, or is that something that was imposed upon you in terms of having to have the book approved before publishing?
That was something that I solely made the decision to do, just for the simple reason that in 2012, I believe, a Navy SEAL published a book, and he did not submit it to the Department of Publication and Security Review. And he ended up going through a lengthy court battle. And I believe now all of his proceeds go directly to the DOD for the life of the book. So,
wow.
I didn't want to get caught up in any legal battles. And I also wanted to go through all the proper channels, so I'm not making sure that I'm not divulging any tactics, techniques, or procedures that the United States government doesn't want me to divulge.
Mm-hmm. So you went through that. How long did it take you to get the book cleared, David?
9 months.
Wow. That's something. And they did didact it. They told you that certain things had to be left out, and you left them out and rewrote them, yes?
Yep, it was about 20 pages in all.
Well, that's not so bad, though. Seriously, when you think about it, you know, they may have been some very kind of interesting and tantalizing pieces, a little bit sensational pieces, but it's really terrific that you did such a good job writing it that you only had to change 20 pages. We're going to take a commercial break, but when we come back, we talked at the pre-interview about where the writing came from, and you know, how when you were discharged and you started to go through your process and found yourself, you know, facing a new enemy, how you began writing and how the book actually evolved. So when we come back, we're going to pick up right there. So listeners, don't go away. We will be back with David very shortly.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. by learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals. To develop mindful, pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way. What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
And today we're speaking with David Burnett, who is a special ops veteran and the author of Making of a Night Stalker. David, before the break, we were talking about how you got your book written and how it began. You were discharged, you got out of the army, and things changed a little bit for you when you were discharged. Why don't you tell us about that, and then how did you come to write your book?
Yeah, absolutely. So I struggled transitioning out of the military early on, right at the onset of my discharge. I realized that brotherhood, that intensity, that adrenaline, all of a sudden was gone. So it was the feeling of getting hit by a Big Mac truck. And that's what I felt. And to numb that pain, I became alcohol dependent. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that I needed to get help. So I went to the VA and I met with a counselor, and she told me to write everything down that was in my head. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty stupid, but at that point I was willing to try anything. So I began writing, and you know, over time paragraphs became chapters, and then chapters became, you know, manifested into 30,000 words, and all of a sudden I realized I was chronologically writing down my military career from beginning to end. And so at about 30,000 words in, I said, you know what, this could be a good book. And so at that point, I told myself, I'm going to write a book.
Wow. And where were you on your journey of recovery from the alcohol dependency? I mean, how long did it take you, and how far in were you in, you know, your transitioning out of the military?
Excuse me. So I was about 6 months into my transition, and I had began writing, but I was still drinking, and I kind of paused for a minute there when alcohol became the most important thing in my life. And I stopped writing, and it wasn't until the end of 2017, an unfortunate event happened where one of my good friends was killed going through the SF qualification course. He was blown up on the homemade explosive range, and I found out about his death, and that kind of triggered a switch in me to stop drinking. And I knew I couldn't stop drinking on my own. So I went to a lot of counseling sessions and group therapy and stuff like that. But I also told myself I need to finish the book. If not for me, for my brother Alex, who was killed, because he can't tell his story anymore. He's dead. And so so ever since September 2017, I haven't had a drink. And so I've been sober ever since then, and it took me about 3 months since September 2017 to finish writing the book, and I got submitted to the Pentagon in January of 2018.
So that kind of happened in a natural but prolonged sequence. It sounds like that the special ops training is potentially very dangerous. I know you, in the pre-interview, you talked about the Dunker School, where you actually have to go and get submerged, I guess, in water, you know, if in case you, while flying, your plane goes down into the water, and there's all these, you know, kind of special things you have to do. Tell us what happened to Alex. I mean, obviously, is it part of the training to have very, very simulated live combat experience? Is that what goes on? How, I know we often hear from time to time, you'll hear about a Jeep accident or a plane accident or, you know, an accidental wounding or something like that. Can you explain that? Because that's also something that we don't know a whole lot about.
Yeah, so in any military training, it's very important to have it be as real or lifelike as possible to the real thing, because you want the training to mimic what the event will be like in real life, just so you're just as prepared for it as you can be. And sometimes when you go to that level, it adds a certain sense of heightened, I guess, heightened risk to it. But these certain types of training, we all know that going in. But to have conducted this training for so many iterations and for something so catastrophic to happen, it should have never happened. And the event where my buddy was killed, I mean, that is still under investigation because it was so catastrophic, and everyone is flabbergasted that it even happened, that to this day it's still under investigation.
Was he the only one who died during the accident?
Yeah, and there were a couple other people who were severely injured.
So it's kind of like a Jeep hitting a mine kind of explosion where it has these catastrophic injuries.
Absolutely.
Wow. And what about the Dunker School? That one kind of caught my attention when we were talking pre-interview, because that sounds rather perilous as well.
Yeah, so they, they have a large staff that is well-trained and have done several iterations of the school. You know, that's their job. And there's several scuba divers underwater while the trainer is submerged with students in it and seat-belted in. So in the event that someone gets stuck underwater, a scuba diver can hand them their breathing apparatus and give them air until they can get them out and surfaced above water.
That must have been a pretty frightening. Can you describe that to us, David? That sounds wow. I assume you have to be a good swimmer, first of all. That's probably part of the prerequisite. And, you know, here you are, you're strapped into a seat and, you know, you're immersed under the water and there's not going to be an instructor with you if this happens. So what is that like? I mean, how realistic and what is that like for you as someone going through that training?
Well, it's very realistic. And, you know, it's the front half of a helicopter suspended by a crane over a giant pool. And the instructor calls out, ditching, ditching, ditching. And the aircraft drops into the pool and starts rotating 180 degrees while you're strapped in. And the floor of the aircraft is essentially a metal grate. And the water starts to fill up in the cabin and, you know, it starts soaking your pants and then finally up to your chest, and you're rolling over at the same time. And, you know, right when the water's up to your chin, you know, you take a deep breath and then you're underwater holding your breath, which is, it's so discombobulating because now all of a sudden everything is opposite where you thought it was because you're upside down. So you have to be able to figure out where your reference points are and unbuckle yourself and egress out the window. Well, they also simulate waves in the pool, as well as rain, wind, and thunder noise. Mm-hmm. So when you surface, the whole warehouse that houses the pool is all blacked out. They have strobe lights going, rain going, wind and waves. So it's very real. It feels real.
Wow. And so, do they tell you how to save yourself before they actually, I mean, are you given instructions so that they don't have to go in and rescue you? I mean, what is the natural procedure in the training? I mean, is the objective for you to know how to get yourself out of this, to have the skills and ability to get yourself out of it so that, because obviously there will not be somebody there to rescue you in the event. So how does that occur? Do you have to do it multiple times?
So it's a very crawl, walk, run process. So the first part of the training, you're in the classroom for a few hours, and then you go out into the pool, and they have these trainers. It's essentially like a floating chair, and you're in the shallow end of the pool, and the instructors strap you in this chair and flip you upside down, and you learn how to hold your breath underwater and egress through that chair in the shallow end. So you get very comfortable learning how to egress in this chair before you actually go into the giant aircraft trainer and flip it upside down. So it's not, they don't just throw you into the big trainer and say, okay, good luck.
So they start you off in a shower?
No. I said a shallow end of the pool.
Oh, a shallow end of the pool. So they do put you in a pool, in the chair. You are immersed in the water, but not too deeply, right?
Right, not in the deep end. And there's a lot of people standing around, so if they see you panicking, all they have to do is flip the chair over and you're out of the water.
Okay. So you've got a couple of runs then. In other words, you have a couple of different things that they put you through. Did you feel ready when it came time for the big experience? Did you feel you had been prepared? And were you able to extricate yourself from that situation?
I did feel very prepared, and if myself or any of the class had any questions, the instructors made us feel very comfortable in asking them questions and not feeling like it was a stupid question, because safety is paramount in an exercise like this. And so I felt very comfortable going into the actual trainer over the deep part of the pool. Yeah.
Wonderful. And so, do you think that for special ops people that the training gives you a sense of kind of skill and confidence and resilience in situations that are catastrophic, and does it help and translate into civilian life? How do you feel about the training you received? Because obviously not many people are going to get that kind of training, David. So for you, does it still remain very meaningful what you've been through?
Absolutely. And, Dunker School is just one school of a laundry list of different trainings and different schools that I had to complete in the military. And 100% without a doubt, I would say I was able to pull something away from each one of those schools that I still utilize in my everyday life. And the big key one would be persistence and resilience. And I always revert back to some of those schools that I experienced, when I'm facing adversity in my life today. And I think, man, if I got through that, this is going to be a piece of cake, So that helps me. That definitely helps me get through some hurdles I face as a civilian.
Absolutely. I would imagine that it would. Now, during the pre-interview, you were talking about your 4 years of clandestine missions. I mean, that's quite a mouthful, clandestine missions, which, the reason it's called Making a Night Stalker is because these occur during the night. These are, very high-level, very dangerous, secretive, clandestine missions. And you have some stories from those missions, David, that you shared with me. And you also shared the nightmares from those missions after your discharge. Can you tell us about some of the stories, some of the really difficult experiences that you had in that unit during those 4 years?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the most difficult missions that I was a part of in terms of loss was just about my third or fourth deployment with the unit as a crew chief, and I was an FMQ crew chief at this time, which stands for fully mission qualified. And we were on the lead bird going to drop in about 60 to 70 Rangers onto this target compound to go after an IED facilitator, higher level guy, and we knew that there could be potential small arms fire going into this place. So we land, drop our team off, and then Chalk 2 lands behind us, and they drop their team off. Chalk 2, I'm referring to, is the second bird or second helicopter in formation, and we both pull pitch or pull thrust, and we start ascending from the target compound while the guys we just dropped off are pulling security or waiting for us to get out of the area. Well, as we're ascending into the sky, I look off the ramp of the aircraft. I was on the left ramp position, and I see a giant explosion. And before I could say anything, the guys on the ground or the ground force relay to the pilots to prepare for a nine line, which alerts the crew right away. We know people are hurt, and a nine line is essentially a medical evacuation a procedure used to relay 9 key components to let the guys coming in to pick them up know what to expect as far as the casualties are concerned. So they pass the 9 line, and the second bird information goes in to pick up the wounded, while our helicopter, we went back to the base to land. And I didn't think much of it at the time. The night concluded, and we went back in and picked up the guys we had dropped off. And when we landed back in the base, the sun was starting to come up. We landed, and Chalk 2 landed. We went over to Chalk 2, or the second bird, to understand what happened that night. And as we're walking back to the aircraft, the ramp is just covered in blood and mud and dirt and whatever else was on the floor. And, you know, myself and the rest of my crew, we were really deflated after seeing that sight. And so one of us ran and got the pressure washer, and we started helping them wash out the back of the bird. And that became a common occurrence, was washing blood and mud out of the back of the helicopter.
You also said there were human parts in there, too. There was, you know, there was the results and the fallout and the material of the injured people that were left behind. And I think you shared what struck you is that, you know, business goes on, business as usual. You know, power wash, you know, the remains out and get ready for the next mission. So you had 4 years of this, correct? You were doing this for quite a period of time.
Yep.
And after that period of time, when you got discharged, you started having some really bad reoccurring nightmares. But I think that might have happened even before you were discharged, but after you were discharged, it continued, which may have been the introduction to alcohol as dependency. David, we have to take another break. When we come back, we want to talk about your nightmares. We want to talk about, you know, you shared that you tried to kill yourself. You tried to commit suicide. And things have to rise to a certain level for us to be in such pain and so despondent. So if you can share with us that transition from military, which is a whole other reality, it's not our, you know, our civilian reality, to living stateside and being stateside and, you know, being back into mainstream culture, as well as we want to talk about something very exciting and a little romantic, what you and I talked about during the pre-interview, why you didn't re-enlist, why you didn't go back, and the choices that you made. So listeners, don't go away. We're going to be back with more, with David's exciting story, and we will return with David Burnett.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way.
What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing Behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
We're back with David Burnett. David is the author of Making of a Night Stalker. He's a special ops veteran who has been through many deployments and tour of duty over in Afghanistan, and he has written a book about his experience. David, before the break, we were talking about a bunch of things. We talked about your stories of what you saw, what you experienced in combat. We talked about the nightmares that began. I had made notes that it was either after the fourth or fifth deployment, and then they continued, of course, when you were discharged, and how you felt you didn't have a purpose anymore and how despondent you had become that you did attempt suicide. So do you want to take us through the start with the nightmares and bring us through to where you came out the other side?
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, me sharing this is in hopes someone listening experienced the same thing will realize that they're not the only ones, that there is help and there are resources out there for them. So for me, it started maybe about 3 to 4 months after being discharged that I really started to experience some heavy nightmares. And it was, excuse me, it was primarily the night I had mentioned before the break, and I would constantly see this bloody ramp, and one of the Rangers who died had two daughters who I had never met, and I would see them running in a field, and that would just always wake me up and scare me to death because I don't know if there is anything I could have done differently that night or the people on the other crew could have done differently. But this recurring theme in my sleep, I could never get to sleep. So what I would end up doing is I'd wake up and I'd just start drinking to get to a point where I could just pass out and not remember anything. So that became that was kind of the linchpin in this downward spiral. And I just began drinking every day and every night, just essentially so I wouldn't fall asleep and have any type of nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
And my alcohol dependency was getting to the point where I began taking it out on my soon-to-be wife, and it was just putting our marriage in jeopardy. And unfortunately, an unfortunate event had to happen for me to stop drinking, and that event was my good friend getting killed during the training course at Fort
mm-hmm.
Bragg.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you said that when you got out, you had been dating your fiancé prior to getting discharged. And when you got out, you did get married.
Yes.
And it not only became, a problem, for you personally, it became a problem for your relationship. And we talked a lot about, I was asking you questions, being a romantic, I'm a romantic, I guess some of us are. My question for you was, you had described the passion you felt. You really loved the helicopters. You loved the missions. You really, for you, that was, I guess it was all adrenaline and excitement and adventure, and it was warrior, and it had all of these components to it that a lot of people, dream about. A lot of people dream about that kind of life and, living that kind of purpose. And for you, it was purposeful and what have you. So I had asked you, I said, David, would you have gone back in, if you hadn't met the woman who you ultimately married? And you said that you would. You would have gone back. You would have extended. You would have stayed where you were. But the real question was, what was the biggest thing? What was the most important thing? Was it for you? Did love kind of overcome ambition and purpose? And we talked a bit about that. And I thought it was your answer was just wonderful, because you always hear about the power of love and how important it is and all of this. And yet when you're at the ultimate, you had kind of reached an ultimate pinnacle of experience in terms of your purpose, in terms of your skill and your desire to be doing what you wanted to do in life. And yet, when everything kind of came to the point of decision-making, you chose to leave the military because you wanted to do something in civilian life, to get married and to do some other things with the partner, the woman you loved. So would you share that? I know, I realize you're a special ops veteran, and being waxing romantic is not something I'm sure you are excited about doing. But can you give us a little bit of that dessert as to how this all evolved for you and your wife? Because it's a special kind of experience, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So my girlfriend, she was my girlfriend at the time. She was with me for three deployments. And I knew that our relationship started to suffer a bit just because I was traveling a lot. And even though our deployments were a bit shorter, when I returned, I would often be sent to a different state to go do training within a few days. So I was always gone. And I knew the divorce rate in our company was really high for this particular reason. And I knew if I stayed in that our relationship wouldn't have much legs to stand on, mm-hmm. just because I knew I would be gone a lot. So I'll always miss war because it gave me the ability to feel like I was making a difference in a major way, fighting alongside men that I could call my brothers. But I left the Army because if I left my soon-to-be wife go, I knew I would miss that love more than I would miss war. War never said she loved me. She just expected me to love her, and I did. But when you find someone that will go to war with you and fight everyday battles with you, then that is true love. So I found my true love to fight a different war alongside me, and that's what we're doing today. So, you know, her and I fight everyday battles together, and now, you know, she's my new battle buddy.
Wow, that is a very that's a pretty marvelous way for you to describe that. I've never quite heard anybody say that they loved war, but I think it was, for you, the way you described it, it was the camaraderie and the purpose of doing good over bad, you know, kind of doing good things when there are bad things that are being done in the world. And your description about your new battle buddy, I think that's really quite wonderful. And although she may have a different take on that, you know, that's really a pretty wonderful way of saying it. We only have a few minutes left, David, but if you would quickly share, I know the veterans take the VA hospitals and the Veterans Administration takes a lot of heat about the care they give veterans, but you had a very positive experience. Can we just close with you talking briefly about the care that you received, and then we'll talk about your website and where people can hear more about you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a great experience with the VA, and I think it's all about the mindset that the veteran goes into the VA with. If they go in with an open mind and not a closed mind because of things that they've heard or read about the VA, I imagine they'll have a much better experience. So that's the mindset I go into the VA with, and 9 times out of 10, I have a much greater experience than if I were to go in with a shutdown mindset. So any veteran listening, thinking about reaching out to the VA, go do it. Go to the VA. Go in with an open mind. And really, the staff there and everyone, I feel, you know, they want to help you. And they will help you.
That's great. And you feel that you got excellent care. And I think that's very important, because now what you're doing, I just want to touch on this before we talk about your website. You are actually working. You've got inventions that you've created for military purposes and, you know, trying to solve problems that were connected with your, you know, special ops work with the helicopters and, you know, with different military machinery and what have you. And so you've taken everything that you got and learned in the military, and you're kind of, you know, paying it back to the military with the work that you're doing now. Do you have your own company?
Yeah, I do. And it was formed in 2016. It's called Tac Clamp LLC. We're still pre-revenue, but this year we intend to have a few purchase orders. It's a clamp used in quick reaction scenarios to aid soldiers on the battlefield on ground or aerial transportation assets.
And that all became clear to you as a result of your experience. So, and you're giving back, and this is wonderful, and it's creating a life for you and your new wife. David, your website is www.makinganightstalker, correct?
Yep, makinganightstalker.com.
Wonderful. And the book is available on Amazon, I presume, and everywhere else books are sold.
Correct.
Okay. If you'd like to get a hold of David, if you'd like to have him speak, or if you'd like to touch base with him, maybe you are a veteran and you'd like to connect with David, go to his website at www.makinganightstalker.com. Thank you so much for being on the show today, David. It has been a pleasure, and we thank you collectively for all of your service, and we wish you all the best with the new work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Georgiana. I really appreciate you having me on.
My pleasure. And listeners, don't forget to join us again next week for another very interesting, insightful, and inspirational show on Living Above the Drama.